With support from Radio Maria, featuring an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, a restaurant of unusual sensibilities. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Glad you could listen. The culture of the workplace and the role of workers in it has changed dramatically in the past century and a half. Around the turn of the 20th century, Frederick Winslow Taylor developed a system he called scientific management, and Taylorism helped transform the manufacturing workplace from a highly skilled craft-based system to a lower-skilled, tightly managed mass production system. But now, 80% of the American workforce labors in the loosely termed service economy, no longer producing physical products on a mass assembly line. And since the 1980s, computer technology has given workers access to vastly greater knowledge and flexibility, enabling them to exercise individual judgment and creative expression in their work. In the digital economy, workers must surely have escaped the confines of Taylorism, haven't they? During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk with a researcher and writer who points to a few problems in this digital paradise. Simon Head is director of the Project on Technology in the Workplace at the New Century Foundation. He's also the author of a book we'll discuss during this hour entitled The New Ruthless Economy, Work and Power in the Digital Age, recently published by the Oxford University Press. In this book, Simon Head details his research into the threads of scientific management woven into the digital workplace and punctures some of the prevailing myths about the effectiveness and justice of Taylorism in the digital age. We'll talk about that during this hour. As we talk with Simon Head, we invite you into the conversation. All you have to do is pick up the telephone. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest, or if you're listening online, anywhere in the continental U.S., 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, if you match the letters with the numbers. Toll-free, 800-222-WILL. And Simon Head joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us.
Great pleasure to be with you.
Great book.
Thank you.
I think most people know something about this thing we call Taylorism, but maybe as a starting point, we could ask you to briefly cover that chapter in our history as you do in your book.
Yes, well, it was an extremely good introduction of yours, if I may say so, because my book is as much a book of economic history as of contemporary economic analysis. And I think the roots of American methods in both services and manufacturing in Taylorism is very important. And I just say two things about Taylorism. It really has two strands, and it's very important to know about both of them. The most familiar and notorious strand is what Taylor did with very basic repetitive work. In his case, the shoveling of pig iron and sand at the Bethlehem Steel Company. And that really is the roots of the methods that Henry Ford worked out on the assembly line at the great Ford plants in Detroit, which have come down to us today in every assembly line you can think of. But the other strand of Taylorism, which is ignored and which leads people to underestimate the sophistication and importance of Taylorism, is the work that Taylor did with the skilled machinist, who was the great aristocrat of labor in the 19th century. And what Taylor wanted to do with this skilled work was to bring it under the discipline of management, to routinize it, and to some extent de-skill it. And that tradition has come down as well. And the descent which I trace in my book is with the methods worked out by the Japanese in the car industry, which have been very influential in American industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, going along with this shift from highly skilled craft workers, essentially, well-paid people doing highly skilled work, their tasks broken down into individual motions and essentially prescribed by management. There's a shift in power here that goes along with this as well.
That's a crucial point, and that's why I don't think one can look at this phenomenon simply in terms of abstract economic principles. The fact that Fordism and Taylorism give enormous power to management is, I think, a goal in its own right. and it explains the tremendous bias in the use of information technology. And the broad thesis of my book is that these methods, which have come down through the manufacturing sector since the beginning of the 20th century, with the digital revolution, are now being applied massively to service industries such as customer service and healthcare. And this is a development of huge importance.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly want to talk about that before we move too much beyond this very basic understanding of where these ideas came from. Mm. We've Taylorism isn't really, the word doesn't really get heard much in workplaces these days, and even in manufacturing, even though the work methods are very similar. They look very similar to the days of Henry Ford's assembly lines. Mm. There's been a great deal of discussions, I think, since the 80s about a sort of, empowerment in the workplace and even in assembly line circumstances that, the Japanese held up as a model of how, you have these teams, these work teams that really are empowered and they can make their own decisions and they can, it's very much different from the previous model. You actually studied these workplaces and what did you find?
Well, you're absolutely right to think that Taylorism is deeply unfashionable and it's not mentioned by anybody. Nobody wants to be associated with it. But I think that if there's one part of my book which is quite original and which draws on the original sources, it is my analysis of Japanese production methods. Because I found, rather to my surprise, that one of the chief architects of the Toyota system, which is at the heart of Japanese methods, in his own CV, describes himself as a faithful disciple of Taylor and describes his life's mission as to apply the principles of scientific management in the contemporary era. And once you start looking in detail at Japanese methods, they are actually a refined version of Taylorism. And I look at them in the context not just of the assembly line, but of something much more complicated, which is the setup of machines. And that goes back to the more sophisticated strand of Taylorism, which I mentioned at the beginning. And I have to say that the whole thesis of autonomous work teams working things out for themselves is a complete myth. What does happen is that workers can contribute to speeding up their own routines, but power to decide how it's to be done rests completely with management. So there really is a need for a big rethink here.
So in essence, you argue that they've been given the power to offer ideas that would speed up their work so management can then speed up the line.
Exactly. I've been around many of these plants, both in Europe and in the United States, and I began to ask a rather subversive question to managers. I'd say, well, you're telling me about all these suggestions that the workers come up with. Now, what happens if a worker comes up with a suggestion that makes the job a bit easier for him, but might add a few seconds to the routine? And the answer is, of course, it never happens. Well, it does happen. It's just that it's never agreed to. Shaving seconds off the routine and speeding them up is the essence of what's going on here, as it was in Taylor's time.
In the case of an assembly line, it's rather easy to control the speed of the process. You just simply speed up the line.
Exactly.
And the more efficient that line is, the more you can speed it up. So in essence, the workers don't necessarily gain anything by the process, but certainly the company does.
That's right. And to the extent that you're de-skilling the process and eliminating the kind of craft element, you can actually pay workers less and they become more dispensable. You can hire and fire them like a commodity according to the shifts in the market. If they're very valuable to the production process and they're not easily replaced, then you can't so easily do that.
Now let's talk about the transition between Taylor's ideas and those of another person that you mentioned, William Henry Leffingwell, who took Taylor's ideas and tried to apply them to service industries like banking, insurance, and mail order houses.
Yes, well, that's extremely interesting, and Leffingwell is almost completely forgotten, and I actually owe my knowledge of him to a very remarkable book which appeared in the 80s, which is called In the Age of the Smart Machine by Shoshana Zuboff, and she wrote about Leffingwell. Leffingwell, like Taylor, was a pretty eccentric character, almost on the edge of madness. I mean, they're both totally obsessed by establishing routines down to the nearest second. And Leffingwell is doing it with things like moving paper and filling in orders and this sort of thing. But what's interesting is that it's much more difficult to do this, or it was much more difficult to do it in the context of the office, because you didn't have the assembly line, the moving assembly line, which is an enormously effective mechanism of monitoring and control in itself. And so there's quite a lot of evidence from the mid-20th century, that the application of scientific management in service industries was not entirely successful. But it's with the coming of software systems and the networked computer in the 1990s that there's a great leap forward in the ability of managers to monitor and control and time all kinds of work in service industries, whether it's customer service or the most notorious example of all, which is healthcare.
We certainly will talk about that before we run out of time.
Yep.
One thing that Leffingwell did is an example would be people opening envelopes. He did studies on the best method for opening envelopes and essentially boosted the efficiency of people opening envelopes by a factor of three or something.
Yes, well, that gives you a sense of the sort of slightly obsessive quality about the whole tradition of scientific management. And that's still true today. I did a lot of work on these call centers, and there are vast numbers of Americans work in them, up to 6 million. And the application of Leffingwell's principles to the call center means that you're extremely meticulous about determining the exact number of seconds that you allow the call center agent to do a task, whether it's answering a customer's request or looking up the timetable of the Greyhound bus. And you're equally meticulous about the amount of time you allow the call center agent between calls. Very, very few, just a matter of seconds. You're meticulous about the amount of time you allow him or her for the lunch break or going to the restroom. So we've got, from Taylor and Leffingwell, this absolute obsession about very, very precise timing. And then once you've got the timing, you then, of course, start thinking of ways to speed it up. And every second counts in the tradition of scientific management.
As you mentioned, we no longer talk about Taylorism, or at least celebrate the Taylor method of organization.
Yep.
But we have had this term over the past decade or so, reengineering, which we hear read in the management literature in many places, almost everywhere.
Well, I mean, reengineering is Taylorism. I mean, I'm going to stick my neck out and say that. They're exactly the same thing. And I've lined up two quotes, one from actually Leffingwell and one from Hammer and Champy, who were the two great early practitioners of reengineering, about how you go about changing the ordering process for goods. And it's exactly the same. And it's really, in both cases, the application of these industrial principles to service work. It's routinization, it's monitoring, and it's de-skilling, and it's the complete subordination of the workforce to re-engineers, or I'd say scientific management. So it's a spectacular example of how the really quite distant past continues to shape the present.
What I thought was really interesting about this section of your book is you describe the introduction of digital technology software that really, I mean, before it wasn't really possible to institute, to re-engineer or tailorize many of the service industries, many of the functions that required human judgment or to handle exceptional cases, exceptional work processes. But with software, that gives management the tools to essentially do this.
Yes, it does. And this is the paradox, I think, of this whole phenomenon, that on the one hand, the technology is extremely sophisticated and extremely intrusive. It's pervasive. And, of course, you can use it in a very creative way, and that's a very important point. I mean, I'm certainly not a Luddite. I'm not against the introduction of technologies. But the critical question is, how do you use it? Because it can always be used to enhance the knowledge, the skill, and the creativity, and ultimately the efficiency of workers at all levels. but it could also be used as a tool of scientific management. And my conclusion, on the basis both of field work, of going around to these workplaces, but also looking at the trade literature, which is something that's ignored by academic economists. Mm-hmm. Trade literature is extremely important because it shows these industries talking to themselves. And it's from the trade literature that you get the sense that this industrial reengineering scientific management approach is really overwhelmingly dominant in these industries.
I found it fascinating to read about your review of some of the trade literature on a field that, this is a term that maybe a lot of people haven't heard, but if you work in information technology, you certainly have heard of customer relations management.
Yes.
And some of the kinds of services and software that are being produced and marketed to corporations for this purpose. I mean, it was perfectly reasonable customer relation management.
Yeah.
You want to manage the information about your customers in databases and to be able to, you know, tap into your own product databases and so forth.
Yeah.
But let me ask you to talk a little bit about what some of the downside of some of these systems might be.
Well, I think this is a field in which the whole thing's got completely out of control. And there is a kind of George Orwell element about this. Just the degree of monitoring and sort of supervision and trying to extend the principles, not simply to timing, but to how people are, to try and mold their whole manner and demeanor. And I think that the bottom line on this is that the quality of the customer service that it produces is very poor. And I've had many call-ins on radio interviews I've done, and I find again and again that people call in and say how deeply discontented they are with the quality of service they get. And one of the reasons is that the call center agent is not allowed to speak of his or her own free will. They've got to speak from these digital scripts, which is an example of Taylorism in service industries. The digital script comes up on the screen, and then there are kind of branching scripts which vary according to the direction in which the conversation's going. And the result of this, I think, is a kind of surrealism in the discussions we have on the 1-800 numbers. We ask questions, but we get the sense that the answer we're getting isn't quite right, doesn't quite fit the question we asked. And this is because the agent isn't being allowed to use his or her own creativity and skill and knowledge to answer the question. So I think the call center world is one of the most egregious and extreme examples of the misuse of information technology in the digital economy.
We have a couple calls to talk with, and I promise I'll get right to them. But just as a way of sort of illustrating the point you just made, I wanted to ask you to talk about the story of Xerox, which is disguised as a MMR Corporation in one revealing study. And their knowledge management system, or CRM system, I'm not sure quite what they called it, known as Case Point, is an example of this.
Yes. Well, that's a very interesting example, and I want to pay tribute to the people who did the work, which is done by a really quite remarkable institution called PARC, the Palo Alto Research Center of Xerox Corporation itself, under a man called John C. D. Brown. And the quality of the work they've done there is really outstanding, some of the great work on the nature of work in the digital economy. And Xerox introduced this system called Case Point, which is dealing with really quite a sophisticated kind of service, which is dealing with Xerox machines going wrong over the telephone. And they thought that they could dispense with skill on the part of the agent simply by having an expert system, and all the agent would do would be to relay the testimony of the customer to the expert system, and all would be well. But in fact, it didn't work at all well because the software engineers hadn't been able to foresee the complex ways in which Xerox machines, rather like human beings, go wrong. So that the untrained agents were always looking for the right description for the particular fault which the machine was suffering from. So the whole—it's a classic example of how you actually can't dispense with the creativity and skill of employees.
It almost became quite humorous reading about some of the transcripts of some of these conversations. People would call with a problem, and you know, I'm just kind of making this up, I guess, but yes. You know, as an example, you know, my machine is broken,
yes.
And then you know, the agent would type in "machine broken," and it would you know, kind of go from there down branching paths of possible, but causes and solutions. But the problem is that people don't necessarily describe things in a logical, orderly manner. And so,
well, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes, I think it's an example of how reality is just much too complicated to be dealt with, to be prepackaged. It can't be anticipated. And again, I hope we're going to talk about healthcare.
Oh, yes.
Because that is supremely the field of human life where these methods are really quite disastrous. But they're quite disastrous enough in customer service, too.
One of the final points you mentioned about this is that there was an instance of a successful solution to a customer problem, but it was only when the agent went off the script.
That's right. It was the case where the agent himself undertook some questioning of the customer. The customer's own language in these situations is notoriously vague and incoherent, and it took the expertise of the agent to sort it out and leap from one inference to another. And I think it's proof, again, that you just can't dispense with human skill.
Unfortunately, that agent, you know, in many cases might have been fired for that.
Well, he might have been fired, but of course the expertise, I think it was a male, he got it on his off his own bat. He'd done it himself. It wasn't expected of him as an employee. I mean, Xerox said quite explicitly that they didn't want to have trained employees. They wanted to avoid the expense and the time of doing that.
Well, we're almost at our midpoint. Let me reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Simon Head. We're talking about his book, The New Ruthless Economy, Work and Power in the Digital Age. And Simon Head is director of the Project on Technology in the Workplace at the Century Foundation. The book is published by Oxford University Press. We have a couple calls to talk with and time for others. If you'd like to join us, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We've kept a couple people waiting. We'll go first to someone in Bloomington, Indiana, on line number 4. Good morning.
Hi, Mr. Head. Recently there have been some...
I just can't hear the gentleman. I'm so sorry.
Hello, can you hear me now?
I can hear you now, yes.
Okay. Recently there have been some very large increases in economic productivity. I assume most of that productivity must be worker productivity. Do you have any insights on what is causing this increased productivity, and also how long can these rapid gains in productivity last?
I don't doubt that they exist. I mean, some economists have raised doubts about it. I think they do exist, and I think that they certainly have taken place in manufacturing, and we've been talking about service industries, but I wouldn't deny that these methods handed down from Ford and Taylor are still quite effective in manufacturing. The Japanese have been able to improve their productivity rather dramatically, and American corporations which have emulated them have done the same. And furthermore, there are segments of the service industries which are very like manufacturing. I mean, for example, the whole world of retail and wholesale and warehouse management and shipping goods along the interstate highways. I mean, these kind of procedures are very susceptible to mass production methods. Think of the parcel delivery guys working for FedEx or UPS with their boxes, which keep them in constant wireless hookup with the managers. So there are quite a lot of segments of the economy where industrial methods work. But my point is that it doesn't work when you cross the frontier into real services, which depend on human interaction, whether it's in customer service, which we've been talking about, or something like medicine, where human interaction is profoundly important. My thesis is that this industrialism doesn't work so well there, and I think you'll see that the productivity figures there are much less good.
You think that these gains continue to last very long, these rapid gains?
I think they can. I think in the areas which are susceptible to industrialization, such as manufacturing and distribution, they probably can. But of course, one of the things that's happening is that as you increase productivity, you lay off workers. You shrink the number of workers you need in those segments. But in the real service industries, you can't do that because you need workers, like in teaching and nurses, so that the balance of employment in the economy over time will shift more and more to what I call pure services, and there the problems of productivity, I think, are very considerable because these industrial methods just don't work when applied to real human interaction.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Great to hear the topic this morning. In reference to the last caller, in terms of the recent productivity, one observation that I've made is I think that people are finally using their computer in an effective way.
Yep.
For when it became available in the 80s and even into the 90s, for a lot of organizations, the computer was a great paperweight and a great way to play solitaire.
Yes.
And finally, in the late 90s and the last maybe 10 years total, people are finally using it in the way it was designed and intended to be used. So I think that's part of the problem, or part of the answer to that that question. So that's just one perspective. I'm not quite sure from this whole discussion, are you supporting Taylorism, are you criticizing it, or is there a little bit of a mix?
I'm criticizing it. I mean, I would make this distinction between manufacturing and services. I think that in manufacturing, it's now so deeply entrenched that I don't think it can really be changed. But I do think that its harmful effects for workers can be mitigated, and that's what labor unions have always done. They've put a check on speed up, which is the great target always of Tayloristic systems. But when we cross over into the kind of service industries we've been talking about it, I'm dead against it. I just don't think it works. I think the attempt to routinize and supervise and time the dealings which customer service agents have with customers, or even more so that doctors have with patients, can't be done. And I think that this is a deeply inappropriate, egregious misuse of information technology and indeed of Taylorism.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. I want to support your perspective on call centers. I'm a consultant that does some work with call centers.
Yes.
And what I find is that when you regulate to the second, you know, the amount of time between calls and time for bathroom breaks and all that sort of thing, there's a technical increase in efficiency,
yes,
but the amount of resistance and conflict that it causes in the workplace is significant. And also, you get the case where employees are always watching the clock. So when they're on the phone, a part of their attention is on the customer and another part of their attention is on the clock, and they're always focused on getting off the call so that they can move on to the next one, because that's how they're being compensated or that's how they're being evaluated. So service actually goes down in a lot of organizations that are highly focused on using Tayloristic principles to manage service people. So I guess I want to agree with you completely on that.
That's absolutely true. And I think that there's very good research, which I quote in the book, by a consultant in Boston called Frederick Reichheld of Bain and Company. And he has shown what the cost of this is in terms of the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
Because these systems result in very high employee turnover, which is expensive for businesses. And it also undermines customer loyalty. So you have a customer churn, and of course that's costly because you're having to give special incentives to bring in new customers. So although to have a very skilled, loyal worker is actually going to cost you more perhaps in your wage and training costs, the rewards in terms of the quality of your service and the loyalty of customers, Reichheld shows, outweighs by far the costs.
I'm looking forward to reading your book to get those kind of figures and statistics, so that's great.
Yeah.
I do want to disagree with just one thing.
Yeah.
When I look at reengineering, I do not see that as being a Tayloristic kind of endeavor. Reengineering, I think, at least in principle, and Hammer and Champy are both pretty willing to agree that it's not been practiced as the principles. It's not been practiced in the ideal when it's been implemented,
yeah,
which explains the 70% failure rate.
Yeah.
But But the way I see reengineering, according to the way it was intended, is it's focused in a macro level on overall processes and on looking at tasks and assignments and questioning their value overall. Taylorism, the way I see it, and feel free to correct me if I'm looking at it a different way, is focused on the specific actions and behaviors required to perform tasks. It doesn't question whether the tasks are appropriate or not, or valuable or not, or you know, really adding to our process. It just makes sure that whatever the task is, we're doing it in the most efficient way possible. Yeah. So I kind of look at those two processes as being one is micro Taylorism, the other is macro reengineering. So I would not personally say that they are the same thing.
I'd have to disagree with you on that. I think that if you look at the work Taylor did with the machinists at the Bethlehem Steel Company, it's very much a question of process. And if you look at the work he did at the Watertown Arsenal outside of Boston, which is one of the great classic examples of early Taylorism, he was very much concerned with process.
Do you talk about this in your book?
I don't think I have, actually.
Well, I'll have to go back and read some of the original stuff. I appreciate the perspective because this is kind of a different way of looking at the relationship between the two, and I would love to be able to look at that again. And I look forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for the call. Other calls are welcome. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere else you hear us, 800-222-9455. I wanted to make sure we spend some time talking about healthcare. Let's talk about the rise of managed care organizations. They were devised supposedly to control rising healthcare costs, but they ended up changing the relationship of doctors and patients and really actually redefining the role of a physician.
Yes, I think that's right. I think this is really the most important segment to look at because it affects all of us, and it affects us in a very private way. I mean, when we're sick, we're very vulnerable to what happens to us, obviously in a way that perhaps in the workplace we're more toughened. And I approached healthcare through these books put out by management consultants, really about reengineering. And I began to see that healthcare was treated just like any other business process in any other segment of the economy, like banking and insurance. Here was healthcare, and it was a question of applying this whole concept of reengineering, of setting up standardized repetitive processes to cover all the activities of healthcare. For example, the way people are processed through hospitals, the way they are processed through clinics, the nature of the interaction between doctors and patients, trying to standardize the amount of time people spend with doctors, and also industrializing the process of diagnosis so that you have this phenomenon called utilization review, whereby these untrained case managers working with rule books and databases would pass judgment on the recommendations of working physicians. I mean, it's an astonishing practice. And I think it derives from the confidence of software engineers that you can simply deduce whether a treatment is going to be effective or not by looking at the database. What you're not doing is to take into account the unique characteristics of the patient, which is what we've tried to do since the days of Hippocrates.
Well, in one maybe simplistic analysis, it seems that a lot of times what they're trying to do is limit contact with a doctor, since a doctor is the most expensive human element in the whole delivery of healthcare, to not only limit the number of encounters but the length of each encounter, so that there are all these efforts brought to bear to maybe help solve a particular person's problem without involving a doctor.
Yes, I think that's right, and I think that's one of the worst aspects of the system. And I quote from a very important book by Kenneth Ludmira, who wrote a history of medical education in the United States going way back to the early 19th century, and he found very strong evidence of this speed-up, this process of speed-up in teaching hospitals, so that medical students just weren't getting enough time to understand and talk about what they were witnessing. And, of course, he comes up with evidence of how the encounter between patients and doctors is being shortened. And I think that's quite disastrous, because doctors need to talk at some length to their patients to grasp and understand their medical history and to get the patient really to talk without inhibitions about what's wrong with him. And when you start abbreviating that and subjecting it to standardization and speed up, you play havoc with the relationship between patients and doctors.
So instead of a doctor and a patient sitting down and discussing and sort of viewing all the things that are going on with the patient,
yes,
in many cases you'd have a screening process and the patient would be fit into a particular disease profile, and then there would be a standardized approach to dealing with that profile instead of an individual approach to the patient.
That's right, and that's exactly right. And of course, there are two things which need to be said here. If you're rich and well off, you can buy yourself out of this. You don't have to put up with it. And increasingly, the population as a whole is refusing to put up with it because you do have this enormous backlash against managed care throughout the country. And as a result of that, you find that the state legislatures, the action here is much more at the state level than the federal, it has erected a kind of framework of regulation so that these decisions handed down by these untrained case managers working for managed care companies can be appealed. There's a right to appeal and a right to review, and therefore the possibility that they will be reversed. But really, they should never have happened in the first place. I mean, it's not the way to deal with the deficiencies of the medical profession. If doctors are sometimes incompetent, the way to deal with that is to train them properly and make them great doctors, not to put power into the hands of these managed care bureaucrats.
Well, I have a couple calls. I promise I'll get right to them, but just to put a fine point on what you just said, There are all these managed care administrators and case managers and utilization review personnel and so forth, and I was astonished by the numbers in your book related to the bureaucracy in the healthcare industry, the number of administrators in proportion to doctors and nurses in the past, 10, 15 years has skyrocketed.
Well, that is absolutely right. And it's a marvelous illustration of how this is a Tayloristic system, because if you go back to Taylor's dealings with the machinist, who was the great skilled worker in the 19th century, he was a powerful figure. And it was actually very difficult for the scientific managers to get on top of him. So what happened in the machine shops in the 19th century was an enormous proliferation of supervisory bureaucracies engineered by Taylor as they tried desperately to bring this difficult worker under control. And that's exactly what's happened in the relationship between managed care companies and doctors. I mean, doctors have great prestige in our society. They're extremely skilled workers, and they've been very effective often in resisting the dictates of managed care companies. And as a result, there's been this spectacular and hugely wasteful proliferation of bureaucracies, managed care companies, specialists in billing, specialists in supervisation, utilization, you name it. And you just quoted the statistics, so that to go back to our discussion of productivity, the productivity of the healthcare industry as a whole, taking into account this bureaucratic proliferation, has been pretty bad for the last 30 years.
We have a couple calls waiting patiently. We'll get on next to someone in Savoy on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Good.
Yeah, this is an interesting discussion. Whenever you talk about reengineering and process changing, from an engineer's point of view, whenever we change a process or anything like that, we always have to go through what we call a hazard analysis, too.
Yeah.
And I think what you're talking about today in the medical industry is whenever you don't do HAZOP analysis, in other words, it's a way of finding hidden flaws in your system that could lead to disastrous results or really undesirable results, whenever you just change a system willy-nilly, and the steps involved in it, it leads to real danger. Have you found evidence of that too?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, I certainly want to make the point that you do have to have processes. You do have to have established ways of doing things. Otherwise, you have chaos. But the essence of that is that you, and particularly in something like healthcare, there has got to be the flexibility to deal with the fact that human health is extremely problematic. We get ill in very idiosyncratic ways, and there is also the whole role of our psychology, even our spiritual condition in interacting with our bodies. That's why the medical art is so revered in our civilization and has been since the time of the ancient Greeks. And somehow these processes in healthcare have got to be flexible enough to allow for that. I mean, for example, in the case of how long people should be allowed to spend in hospital, it seems to me outrageous that you should have these really very rigid rules that if you have a certain surgery, a certain illness, you have the right to X days in hospital. The role of the physician in determining the physical and spiritual, psychological state of the patient and in deciding really how much time he needs in the hospital has to be paramount. So, yes, you do need processes, but also you need them to have a lot of flexibility, above all in healthcare.
Oh, yeah, I was just, looking at it from the point of view of, even when you have a very reliable process and you understand it, and then you even contemplate changing it, at least in the engineering world,
yes,
you have to look at the consequence of could this change introduce a hidden flaw, and there's various ways of finding out whether the introduction or taking away of a step would result in serious danger.
And I think that's obviously true, and I think that the early re-engineering at the time when Hammer and Champy wrote their book was pretty cavalier in sort of messing around with processes with pretty disastrous consequences.
Yeah. Well, I got one other question, too. I wanted to just comment on it, and I'll hang up. Yeah. We've also run into, in this regards productivity, we've also run into, where I think these very rigid, like these ISO 9000 and quality control and quality assurance programs, they just it's a paper blizzard, and it really prevents innovation. It prevents people from changing to something better. And the resistance is, well, gee, I have to tell my customer that I've got something better. I've actually heard that.
Yes.
Have you...
That's not a field, really, that I've done much work in, but it certainly sounds very plausible what you're saying.
Well, hey, it was an interesting discussion.
Okay. Yep. Thanks so much for the call. Yep. All right. We'll go next to a listener on line number one in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, I hear your guest talking about efficiency versus effectiveness issues is the way I hear it. And like that you're saying that when it comes to working with lower level workers, there's sometimes a real problem with implementing Taylorism, that's no, I don't think anyone can reasonably argue with that. I'm just wondering if you think you talk about productivity, and you've kind of glanced on several times now the possibility, or maybe a glimmer of insight into the possibility of imposing higher efficiency and productivity standards on managers and owners, and maybe on the financial sector even, when you were talking about the healthcare sector and how the administrators make so much money, and that's true across nationally. Anybody in the financial sector has been doing well, and yet what probably should be the key measure of their productivity, at least for the nation, their creation of living wage jobs, they fail miserably. So have you got any thoughts about Taylorism and management and all that? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Yes, I mean, I think that the caller made a crucial point, which needs to be emphasized again and again, and that is that you've had productivity increases, but they have not been matched by increases in employee compensation, and by that I mean wages and benefits, including healthcare benefits. And really, that was the starting off point for my whole book, that, you know, why is this? Because orthodox economics has always said that if you achieve increases in productivity, they're going to be matched by increases in worker compensation. Well, they haven't been, and you have to look very carefully why, and that's really what I've tried to do in this book.
Well, I may be reading this into the caller's question, but it also seemed to me that he was suggesting that, you know, perhaps management ought to be held to some kind of standard for performance, you know,
yes,
the way that workers are. And
yes,
I guess this, you know, since, you know, there essentially is a huge shift in power that comes with this kind of organizational practice and the technologies used to implement it. And we see that throughout, you know, the corporate sector right now, and I think a lot of the scandals that have broken in the past few years with Enron sort of emblematic of that. And, I also sense that people are growing fed up with it.
I think that's right. And I think the point needs to be made that the further away you get from classical manufacturing and into the service sector, the more difficult it is to measure productivity. I mean, if you're measuring the productivity of the Ford plant, it's quite easy because you've got the Model Ts or the Thunderbirds or whatever coming off the line. But when you get into customer service or healthcare, it's much more difficult. How do you measure the productivity of healthcare? Do you measure it simply by the number of people being processed through the hospital? Well, the answer is no, because the crucial thing is, have they been cured? What is the consequences of the treatment they've received? And once you start to try and establish that, then you're having to follow them up for months or even years after they've left the hospital. So the productivity miracle, I think, becomes less and less impressive the further away you get from the classical assembly line.
We have just about maybe 6 minutes left. If someone wants to call real quick, we'll try to get you into the conversation. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. I want to talk a little bit about enterprise resource planning. ERP is another now buzzing acronym, all the rage, one might say, in IT and organizational practice. I see it everywhere because I deal with technology a lot.
Yeah.
But it also seems quite fuzzy. Can you talk about what it is and what it is supposed to be?
It's enormously fuzzy. I'm very glad that you raised it. It really is the great black hole of the information technology economy. We've been talking about engineering, re-engineering, and this was originally to deal with very specific procedures like ordering and moving goods. But what ERP tries to do is to apply these methods to practically everything and to create and to join up these processes so they work as some sort of vast mechanical entity. So you're talking about ERP being applied to accounting, to personnel management, to strategic planning, to decision making at high levels. And the company that has pioneered this is called SAP, which hardly anybody's ever heard of. It's actually a German company, which is interesting because we think of the great IT companies as being American, but SAP is very much a German company. It's interesting that we've been talking about the backlash against certain IT systems in, say, healthcare. I think there's been a backlash against ERP systems in the corporate world because their promise of creating a vast kind of quasi-mechanical entity coordinating and relating all the processes of a business has just proved to be too much. It just can't be done. And it tends to stifle the particular culture and creativity of whole departments of businesses. But it's a crucial area, and it's almost completely unknown.
Well, now, if we could describe a little bit more clearly what it is this is supposed to look like. Isn't it, in essence, you have all these databases, whether it's the accounting, you know, the billings and the receipts section and the customer records database, and then your suppliers and your workforce databases, and all these things essentially have been separate. And ERP is an attempt to wed these things and then establish some rules of how they interact and what decisions get made in certain circumstances.
Is I think there are certain sort of rather mechanical areas where it probably works quite well. If you think of the customer service agent taking orders,
sure,
and then how do you communicate those orders to the warehouse or the factory? I think at that level, it probably does work. But it's when you get into things like personnel management and you're trying to use databases and algorithms to formalize and to some extent computerize the process of selecting people to do things for jobs, I think that it doesn't work because, again, it excludes the complexity and unpredictability of human beings. And I think it works less well at a high level of corporate activity, such as planning and running whole projects. And that's the evidence so far, because there's been a pullback in the corporate world from expenditure on these projects. And that's why the level of IT investment in this phase of the economic recovery has actually been rather disappointing.
We're almost out of time, and I'm sorry, there's much more we could talk about. And I just want one last question. It's probably way too big with the time remaining, but people will often feel technology is an irresistible force, and of course it brings some bad as well as good, but most of us simply accept it as a given. We've talked about how 80% of Americans now work in service industries, a growing number of which are adopting these technologies and practices.
Yes.
How can we participate meaningfully in these workplaces while protecting our interests as working people?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and I'd very quickly make a number of points. I think, rather unfashionably, that unions are more important than they've ever been, or they've been since the 1930s, because the way in which workers, certainly in manufacturing, but also in a place like the call center in healthcare, they can only really have a voice, and they can only really protect their dignity through unions. So I'd like to see labor laws changed to make it easier for workers to organize. I would also say that there are encouraging examples of consumers and customers simply refusing to put up with some of the products that these systems come up with, and we've talked about two of them. We've talked about the backlash against managed care and the attempt to dictate medical decision-making to doctors. The public opinion has played an enormously important role there. I'd also mention the telemarketing law, because the intrusion of telemarketers is outrageous and is deeply bound up with the use of these automatic systems, and people are so outraged about it that there's a law which now enables people to opt out of getting calls from telemarketers. I would like to see that pressure and discontent extend to the whole area.